Well, we might just go ahead and get started since we're just a couple minutes late anyway, and since lunch is on the tail end, so there is real punishment for running over at this time of day from there. Thanks to everybody for coming. This session is called What Should We Do About the Holden Mind? My name is John Jensen. I teach at Luther College and work in the Environmental Studies program, but I want to be clear that my background is in philosophy. I am not a hydrologist. I am not a mine engineer. I'm not any of those things. And my background on this comes primarily from looking at this as a case study with groups of students the last two Januaries when we were up here and trying to understand it as much as possible and trying to work through some of the issues that are there. And so what I want to try to do today is to provide a pretty quick summary of the situation as I understand it. And I'm thrilled that Chuck Carpenter could be here to correct me as many times as needed with some of the background stuff that's there. And my hope is to go through some of the factual background. Again, very quickly, you could stop me with questions at any time. The hope is to do that in 15 or 20 minutes so that we would have time for question and answer and discussion around what, for my simple outline, I simply called the bigger questions that are there. And some of those are more hypothetical. As I'm going to argue as we go through here, an awful lot of what is happening is in some sense determined by the organizations involved and various laws, which I'll talk just a little bit about, but not a lot. But then I think it's worth backing out to ask some of the bigger questions about what we as a society can learn about cases like the Holden Mind, etc. from there. So a couple of caveats. One is I am no expert in any of this, and some of you may know more about it, and Chuck in particular, please feel free to interrupt me at any time. The other one is my goal that I want to say from the very beginning is to radically simplify an incredibly complex case. And so when I say remediation in 1 minute, there are piles and piles of documents that have been prepared. And if you go upstairs here, you guys, Chuck, have a separate bookcase simply full of binders, full of documents. And I'm sure you don't have everything that's there. And these days it's increasingly electronic in terms of making stuff available from there. I'll talk a little bit about the role of kind of the courts and litigation in cases like this. But there are lots of stories of lawyers who make a big production in court about taking hand carts full of documents and rolling them into courtrooms to make points about the amount of study that's taken place with some of these cases. And I think you could do that in this case. And if you sort of took all of the studies and all of the documents that have been prepared and stacked them up vertically, I'm confident it would be higher than this room and it might be higher than Koinonia. I mean, it's just incredible the amount that goes into things like this. And so my apologies to say I'm going to really simplify and in the process probably make some mistakes, but also, again, an invitation to ask any questions as we sort of go through there from there. My quick outline, what's the problem? I want to really quickly talk about how we got here and the pollution as it stands right now. Talk a little bit about who are the different organizations involved in this and how that process sort of plays out. Again, fairly quickly, talk just a little bit about Superfund law and the National Environmental Policy Act, the two of which I think sort of shape a lot of what's going on, but not too much. Explain what, in very simple terms, again, what's planned in terms of remediation, and then, again, hopefully quite quickly get into the larger questions that are there. And again, feel free to stop me at any point to ask questions, et cetera, as we go through. I think most people know a little bit anyway about how to throw markers around the room, and I know that too. But I think most people know a little bit about the mine and have read that history. A huge copper mine at the time that it was running, an underground wet mine bringing large quantities of rock material out, crushing that into a powder or something finer. That was processed using chemicals to separate out the good stuff from the bad stuff, to sort of separate out the stuff that was rich in copper and other metals that they wanted from the waste stuff. Very common process in mining, but also a very sort of chemical intensive process to do that separation. And then shipping that ore down the mountain, down the lake, back onto to trucks to get it to the rail line and then heading over to Tacoma to fuel the industrial growth of the United States, to fuel the war effort at that time. Operated it for 20 years, and then you leave. And what's left behind? Well, one piece of what's left behind is Holden Village. And I think it's good to remind ourselves continually, if there hadn't been that mining operation, Holden Village wouldn't be here. It's an incredible sort of legacy of that mine. But the other incredible legacy, and to me what's interesting about being here in the summer instead of the winter, is it's always in your face, is the mine site and those tailings piles as they stand right there. They've been there for 60 years, more or less, as they are now, and have been more or less in the same situation, but also more or less continuously providing a source of pollution into this valley. And when we think about that pollution, at least for me, I break it down in a couple of different ways from there. The pollution itself, when we think about it, is in the soil. There's air pollution as a part of that, that those tailings are toxic in a sense, that if I took my kids and decided that I really wanted to have a nice new sandbox and started digging into the tailings pile up there and had them digging into that as they got further down into there, they're on the surface, no problem as I understand it. If you got far enough down into it in places, they would be into levels where they were exposed to heavy metals in quantities and concentrations that go beyond human health standards from there. But essentially, there's no active human health risks on the tailings as they stand right now, but there is toxic soil, there is toxic sort of tailings that are in there, in amongst things from there. Air pollution, not so much now, but in the past, and I don't know the timing of this, but there used to be the case that that it was exposed enough that winds would blow, and it would blow contaminated dust off the tailings, and that posed an air pollution hazard, but also deposited a certain amount of toxic dust, toxic dirt, partway down the valley on the soils that are in there. And so they came back in order to address that and put a cap over the top of the tailings. Chuck, am I right that there hasn't been air pollution in the last, since they did that capping, there's not sort of active air pollution as there was in the past?
Yeah, I wasn't here before.
Right.
But as I understand, yeah, it's really dropped it down.
Yep.
In the early 80s, when I first started coming here, the tailings weren't so protected, and so the dust had billowed up. Some people said their eyes, they could actually feel it, but you could at least see it at that time.
Yep. And that there are, as I understand, they've done tests and there are detectable levels of some of the contaminants, say, in the woods as you would head down the road going down from here. So the air pollution, I mean, I would say the soil pollution is not a huge thing, but is out there. The air pollution is something that is at least at this point from the past. When I say pollution or hazards, I guess I would say, to put it up there, there is this danger, which maybe isn't a one right now, but of some sort of a slide. If you look at the tailings, they're very steep. If there was an earthquake, if there was some sort of other situation that something could slide, what is basically not a problem now could become a problem. And one of the things that we have to be aware of is that danger that there could be some sort of a slide in the future from there. But the big thing that people are focused on here is water. And I think that's where the primary contamination is, and that's where the primary work related to remediation is in terms of the water. And I like to think of it in terms of two different sources of the pollution and then two different impacts, again, to simplify. There is mine pollution coming out of the portal where the mine portal where they went in initially. If you've walked up to the third level, you can actually see water coming out there at times. And my understanding is there's essentially hydrologic pressure from underneath that is pushing some of that water out, and it's coming out of the mine portal. And that water, and really with all of this, what we're talking about as the primary pollutants here is heavy metals. Copper, zinc, chromium, arsenic, lead, cadmium, at least in places. Silver gets referred to, a variety of heavy metals that are in there as that situation. And the other source is coming out of the tailings piles. So you have these large piles of tailings. As is the nature of water, it tends to move through any sort of porous surface, so you have water leaching through the tailings, picking up heavy metals, and then finding its way down from there. And I think really with both of these, so if we think not just of sources, but then of the impacts, again, it divides in that some of that is on surface water. So Railroad Creek, the water that's coming both out of the portal and from the tailings is finding its way into Railroad Creek, and also there is contamination of groundwater. So it is not only finding its way into the creek, but seeping down into the groundwater as well. Lots of groundwater wells have been tested, and they are finding unacceptable levels of heavy metals in those groundwater wells in various places around. And I don't know, I mean, you can look at the plots of, you can look at, there's just mountains of data in terms of what has come out of there, but there is in places, there is contamination of the groundwater as well from there. Just so we're clear, and Chuck, you can jump in because this question has come to me before. Holden Village doesn't take any drinking water from the groundwater, is that right?
Correct.
Okay.
our water sources.
Right. So there's no, you don't have to think about it the next time you turn the tap or get a glass of water at Holden. All of that is coming up, way up above any of this coming out of Copper Basin. So it's pure water. So that's not affecting the village directly. So it's not a concern.
How far down Railroad Creek is it impacting with both groundwater and the surface water? Because I was a little surprised to hear it's not being tested in Chelan where it drops down into Lucerne. So it's somehow being dissipated.
Yeah, I think one of the take-homes in understanding the pollution that's here is it's fairly limited in its geographic scope, that it is not this huge area, and people ask about, is it affecting Lake Chelan, is it affecting Lucerne? The answer seems to be an unequivocal no, that by the time you have moved a few miles downstream, and I don't know exactly when, but well before you get to the lake, there does not seem to be detectable levels or levels of concern of the contaminants, and it seems to be a healthy functioning stream ecosystem. Because the impacts here are, I think it's safe to say from my point of view, that the stretch of Railroad Creek that we're looking at here is sort of ecologically dead in a sense. That the impact is significant enough that on macroinvertebrates and on the fish populations, that it is not a healthy functioning ecosystem. It is at least functionally dead here. But it does seem to clean itself up, or it does seem to not be a problem as you move further downstream. So it's not moving all the way down. Yeah.
My understanding is that the primary impact on the invertebrate population relative to the tailings is more of a mechanical than a chemical issue. It's actually the coating and sort of silification of the creek bed. It's not that the water itself is toxic, it's that the bed of the creek doesn't support invertebrate life, small bugs and stuff like that. Is that accurate?
Yeah,
it's really more of a mechanical silification issue and the oxidized metals that, and you can sort of see that oranging of the creek, that section that you can see it from the aerial photos, has less life as a function of sort of the mechanical.
Yeah, there's two things: the heavy metals coming in, but then yeah, the iron oxide flocculant that's coating the rocks and then prohibiting microorganisms and growth from happening.
Right. Yeah. So they use the term ferrocrete as that sort of iron oxide coating that is almost functioning like a concrete over the stream bed and makes it such that it doesn't support the plants and doesn't support the insects in a way that sort of a natural stream bed would from there. But I think that's an accurate characterization, that it is the sort of mechanical versus chemical that's affecting, say, fish and insects, etc.
How far outside of the stream or does the impact extend? Like you have it's called the riparian zone along the river. How far outside of into that zone is the ecosystem affected by these both, I guess, mechanical and chemical impacts? Is it pretty limited to that stream, you know, the stream bed, or does it extend further out into the?
Chuck, you correct me if I'm wrong. I mean, the groundwater contamination clearly extends further out. And I think this is a system where there is some interplay between surface and groundwater between those two. And I don't know. I mean, I know they've drilled test wells probably up behind the village, et cetera. Mm-hmm. But I don't know, you know, how far out you get before you're not finding those pollutants as well. Do you have a sense of that from looking into it? Or...
I'm not a scientist, but I think that from the creek, you know, the contaminants are either being coming through the tailings and up, you know, from this area here. They're either surfacing into the creek or, and correspondingly, the creek is losing water into the ground. One or the other, those, like John said, they're intertwined. Beyond this sort of major impact zone, I think it is about a mile and a half of more detectable than the images. The surface impact of the tailings, especially, you know, and from surface contaminants is, you know, Honeymoon Heights, there is even a spot at the ballpark that they're investigating, and then that wind blowing tailings goes further down that impact.
In terms of the effects sort of on the ecosystem and the critters and plants, et cetera, it's a good question. I don't know that I've seen anybody address it. So if you have essentially a dead creek, presumably it affects other things around from there. If you're walking around and looking at it, it seems like a pretty healthy riparian zone as you come up to it. And I don't know. I don't know enough about it from there.
There is quite a bit of invertebrate studies on there's a couple different type of toads and spotted lizards or salamander type things that are native to this area, and they do have studies on test areas.
Do we see any animals using the creek or looking the creek, like beavers or even deer going down to drink?
Yeah.
And my understanding on the invertebrate study is that there's a distinction between biomass and biodiversity, that the actual counts of invertebrates, mm-hmm. Frogs and toads, or whatever, the actual biomass hasn't changed dramatically, but the number of different species has dropped off, and so that there are some species that aren't found in Railroad Creek as much as they had been historically, but those have been displaced and replaced by greater numbers of other critters.
Yeah, that would be very accurate, I think. Because where the tailings are right now, really historically was a wetland, and so the habitat that was displaced would have been a wetland habitat and would have lost.
It's maybe a minor issue, but I think it affects the way that we think about response. And I would tweak where you have slide risk.
Yep.
I would change that to certainty.
Okay.
That's inevitable. That those landforms are not stable. And this is a system, I mean, mountain systems are inherently, all you do is look up the hill and major events come down, the fluctuating water table, the fact that it's on a wetland, those are new piles, the solution, they're gonna shift.
Mm-hmm.
There's gonna be, eventually, those are gonna slump or mm-hmm. flush or something. And when they do, that stream will flush. And then we've got a massive spread. So eventually, you know, hindsight's gonna be 20/20 at
yep.
that point. We're going to say, how come we didn't see this
right.
disaster? And then we'll go down.
Yep.
And I think the engineering drawings from way back when they built those edges, they're beyond the angle of repose, so they're really steep. But
yeah.
I think they used block cribbing to set up those edges. And so, yeah, at some point, that would fail.
That'll fail. Yeah. And you just look at them, the landforms, the geomorphic processes, we go from unstable to stable, and that will, it's got to.
And I think it's helpful because I do think that, and we'll get to this a little bit later on, I think it's for the lay person, it's easy to say, hey, it's stayed there for 50 years, it'll stay there forever, and not so. But I think our sort of limited time frames sometimes
exactly.
puts into that sort of thinking.
Yeah. may not be this generation.
Very quickly, let's talk about who all's involved in this and why is it taking forever and what's sort of playing itself out from there. And I want to do this quite quickly and again ask Chuck to help correct me as I go through it from here. The U.S. Forest Service is the lead agency in making this decision. They own some of the land. They own the land around here. The Forest Service is in the business, essentially, of land management. But in this case, they are the agency that is taking the lead, that has sort of primary decision-making power and primary coordination power from there. But I think of it as sort of this government triad that's there. Along with that, the EPA is involved. The EPA takes the lead really on the process of cleanups of this sort. And as some of you probably know, the EPA is in the business of implementing Superfund law, and they do this in Tacoma. They do this all around the country, is try to work to clean up toxic sites as much as possible. And I'm going to come back to that in just a minute. And then the third one here involved is the Washington Department of Ecology, which my understanding is their primary concern here is water and wildlife. They are responsible for enforcing and managing in terms of water quality standards within the state of Washington, and they're interested in making sure that we have healthy ecosystems, that that is essentially their primary function. So three different government agencies, two federal, one state, with three different priorities, but working together to try to achieve a common plan as it goes forward from there. And whatever we think about government and all the jokes that come along with it, there is at least some truth to the fact that things work somewhat slowly when it's involved with government from there. In this case, the Forest Service is governed by what's called, and all of these agencies are to some extent, but particularly the Forest Service as the lead agency, is governed by what's called the National Environmental Policy Act, or NEPA. And NEPA is an act that was put into place in the late 1970s, really as a way to govern the process that organizations, government agencies, go through in making decisions. And NEPA, for some people, their whole lives are governed by NEPA because everything is really about process. And things tend to be focused on what's called an EIS, or Environmental Impact Statement, for NEPA. I guess the one thing that I want to say, because I think it's helpful in thinking about this, is the idea behind NEPA was to have a process of making decisions that was consistent, was public and open to the public for comments, was intentionally deliberative, it is slow by design, and is at least designed to be fair and to take into account all the information to try to arrive at the best decision. And if you sort of keep in mind the sort of public, deliberative, consistent, fair part of that, you recognize why it takes a long time to sort of make these decisions. And then if you add in another bit of history, particularly over the last 20 years, I would say, which is organizations, I would say particularly environmental groups, sort of recognize that NEPA was this awesome tool for them to work on their agendas. And so there are environmental groups that basically have made their business NEPA lawsuits to slow down processes, to try to halt things that they don't want to go forward before. Particularly in some of the heydays of timber wars in the West and the Northwest, basically every single timber sale was challenged in court on NEPA grounds. And some of those were really legitimate lawsuits that said, hey, you're trying to pull a fast one by cutting down some timber without going through the proper processes. Some of those, the groups involved simply knew that they had no basis, but knew that they could slow things down by filing a NEPA lawsuit in the process. What's happened as a result of that, and I think it's important to keep in mind, is government agencies have gotten much more careful and have gotten pretty gun-shy about decision-making processes, and so it tends to slow things down because they don't want to end up in court later on, and so they're trying to dot every I five times and cross every T as they go through and make sure that they have all of their ducks in a row to hopefully avoid litigation later on. Now, I don't know that much about the specifics of this case other than it seems to fit the model of things just take a long time, and it seems like you're going to decision here, and you don't, and then it's not coming here, and it's sort of coming down the road. But part of this process, which it goes through, is you have an initial sort of scoping period where you're sort of checking out what's going on. You have to come up with a range of alternatives to consider, and I think Chuck was saying we're on version 14, but there is, I know at one point it was 13 M, N, O, and P or something, so there's, I think it's safe to say there have been many, many different alternatives. You come out at some point with a proposed decision that says here's our preferred alternative and here's why, but then there has to be a public comment period, which I think some of you probably commented on it, and then they have to respond to all of those comments in one way or another. And the failure to respond to a comment could result in a lawsuit that says you failed to follow the NEPA process going through. And so I think it's important to sort of keep that in mind. And, you know, is this an example of government run amok, or is this an example of government avoiding favoritism and making sure that we make the best decision? I don't know. It's your perspective in terms of how you come about it from there. The EPA is governed very much in this by what's called CERCLA, or we think of it as Superfund, but the Comprehensive Environmental Repair Compensation and Liability Act, I think. But it goes back to 1980, and some of you may be familiar with the case of Love Canal, which really was the driving force behind this piece of legislation where you had essentially a neighborhood built on top of a toxic waste dump, and we didn't know about it. So Superfund is really the law that governs the EPA in cleaning up toxic waste sites. And essentially what the EPA has to do is identify these sites. They have what they call a national priorities list, which tries to prioritize them to try to identify the responsible party. This is very much a polluter pays law. Let's get those evil corporations to have to pay for their messes when you clean them up. That's at least some of the rhetoric that goes behind it. But then the ultimate goal, and I think that's what fits what's going on here, is to have a permanent cleanup of potentially hazardous sites over time. And I think that's what's coming on. Now in this case, and I'm going to try to wrap this up pretty quickly, the responsible party is clearly identified in the Rio Tinto Mining Company. They didn't mine it here, but the mining claim got bought in different cases, and that I love the way that Steph described this at the meeting the other day. It's like when you go to an auction and you buy a box or a bag with a mixed bunch of stuff in there. You don't know until you get home what's actually in there. Well, Rio Tinto bought Intalco, which was this big mix of different mining claims, and inside there was the liability for the whole mine. Rio Tinto's interest in this, I think, is to have their legacy, their public relations look good, and to wipe this liability off their books. If I'm the chief financial officer for the Rio Tinto Mining Company, I got this liability that I'm carrying around over time. And yeah, I'm not thrilled about paying a couple $100 million out, but I really don't like keeping this unknown liability on my books that at some point 10 years from now, some young holding director comes in and decides to sue the mining company, and what I thought was going to cost me $200 million cost me $500 million and a lot of bad publicity. So I think the mining company has said, hey, we'll clean it up, we'll pay for it. And that's partly, I think they want to do the right. I mean, I get a sense that these are people that say it seems like the right thing to do it, but it's also partly on the financial side. It just makes more sense to pay out the money and get that liability out rather than to have to carry it on forward from there.
Does the church have a liability as a property owner?
Does Holden Village in this sense?
Yeah.
I mean, this is the other party here, and I am intentional in putting one on top and one on the bottom in terms of where it is. I am not aware that Holden Village has a liability as a property owner here, since the mining claim is what's owned by Rio Tinto. And my understanding is that the primary liability anyway goes along with the mining claim, not necessarily with property ownership. But can you comment on that, Chuck? Or
I know that we own the actual Hansen Mining claim.
Okay.
Anyway,
But potentially, I mean, and if these things get into, if somebody decides they want to sue, they're naming everybody they can potentially. That's sort of the nature of things these days.
You know, it would be sort of like suing the homeowners who had homes on top of Love Canal. Essentially, you could sue the poor people whose houses are built on the toxic waste dump because they now own half an acre of the toxic waste dump.
Right.
Yes, people go where there's money. Right.
And from, just to fill this out, I mean, from the, and when we think about the larger sort of process, I mean, holding this sort of neighboring community. And when you do a cleanup, you want to do right by the neighboring community, but the neighboring community doesn't have a huge say in that process as it goes through from there. And I think that Holden has been involved all along and has tried to keep inserting themselves into it. But I guess my understanding is it's not as if Holden is a primary decision maker here. You can sort of help to influence the process in some ways as it goes forward, but you're not the primary sort of decision makers. And I think there have been good relations that sort of that helps to foster cooperation as it goes forward, which is not always the case and hasn't always been the case in this particular issue as well. From there.
Will you detail for us what they're doing right now and what they're going to be doing?
I'm not going to detail, no. But I will give the very quick sort of rundown of what's happening. And if nobody has questions about the other sort of piece of it, partly I wanted people to see who's making decisions and why does this take longer, et cetera, from there. I should have brought like the aerial photo from upstairs that sort of shows who owns what. The Forest Service owns most of the land around, including the Forest Service owns the land that we are on right now, where Holden Village is on. Holden Village owns, about 200?
It's about 230 to 240 acres mm-hmm. of the Copper Mountain, kind of a chunked up patent to the mountain.
Most of the tailings would be on Forest Service land, I believe.
Only thing outside of in the Holden property goes from where the yurts are by the ballpark and it kind of shoots up the mountain. It's at a bit of property on the third level where the rock tiles are is Holden property and where the mill structure is, the mill structure. Mm-hmm. So most of the contaminants are on Forest Service property.
Mm-hmm. Rio Tinto doesn't own any land, but they sort of own the liability for the cleanup.
And the mineral contents in the mine, because I know that was an issue that was raised at the meeting earlier. What if suddenly it becomes profitable to open the mine up again? Who owns the mine and the mining? You said something about mining rights or
patent. I think I don't know the exact legal documents, but I understand pretty confident that those rights have been relinquished.
I want to do my remediation in 1 minute. Let's see if I can do this or not. What are they going to do for the remediation? Dramatically oversimplified, what they're going to do is they're going to cap the portal and capture the water that comes out of it. So we said before that one of the sources was stuff coming out of the portal that was coming out from there. They're going to put a cap on that and capture the water that's coming out of it from there. They're going to build a large barrier wall, or they call it a slurry wall. So basically between the creek and the tailings, there will be a concrete wall down to bedrock, the full length of the tailings going down. Not a solid one. As I understand it, sort of will kind of loop around Copper Creek as it comes in to capture things from there. And again, the idea as part of that is to capture all of that water that's coming out. Thinking back to our water pollution that's there. They will treat all of that polluted water from both of those sources, both the water that is captured coming out of the portal and all of the water that essentially is coming through the tailings, hits up against that barrier wall, will be captured. They will build a new wastewater treatment plant. At times there was talk about two treatment plants, but from what I understand, the plan at this point is to build a single wastewater treatment plant so that water will, as I understand it, both a combination of some gravity and some pumping, pumping all of that captured polluted water to a wastewater treatment plant in order to treat all of that water. And then the fourth thing they will do is they will regrade and cap the tailings. So back to soil pollution, potential air, or this idea that it's going to slide at some point. You change the angle of that so that it doesn't have that same sort of slide risk, and you put a cap on top of it so that there's no exposure to the toxic soil and there's no possibility of air pollution going forward from there. Now that's my, shucks, 2 minutes. But in order to do that, what do you have to do? You have to cut down a whole bunch of trees and make way for a lot of equipment. You have to create a road that can take two-way traffic with huge trucks coming in from it there. They're going to put a new bridge across Railroad Creek so that they can get their trucks over onto the other side. So the plan is, and if you have questions about this, I direct them more towards Chuck than to me, is to spend 2 years in preparation, sort of laying the groundwork, getting set up for equipment, making sure that people are ready, that the basic sort of preparation work is done, and then you come in over the course of two summers, or spring, summer, fall, sort of two seasons, to do the vast majority of this work that will take place over time, because it's a huge job in order to be able to do that. I mean, I can simplify it into four steps, but to do each of those requires millions of dollars, probably billions of tons of rock that's moved around. You're talking about that barrier wall, at times 80 feet below grade down to bedrock in order to be able to make that wall to be able to contain those tailings as they come through from there. But the idea is then you would direct that you, over the course of, say, the next 5 years, but primarily focused under the current schedule in the summers of 2013 and 2014, you accomplish the sort of containment of the pollution, and then the wastewater treatment would be operated for a long time into the future in order to be able to have that under control.
It seems to me, though, that, I mean, isn't this essentially kind of a temporary solution? I mean, you know, we all look at old concrete structures. They all eventually, the rebar rust, they crumble. I mean, in 100 years, not being a naysayer, I'm just thinking those tailings are going to be there for the next 10,000, 50,000 years. And that barrier wall crumbles away. Aren't we back where we started from? I mean, who's going to operate this water treatment plant centuries into the future?
We thought you were.
No, no. I mean, I think it helps right now, but this seems inherently temporary in nature.
I think that's, from my reading though, that's sort of the nature of Superfund settlements, is you never get to, whether it's Love Canal or Asarco in Tacoma or anywhere, it's never returned to its pristine natural state. There's a settlement between what can actually be done reasonably with the finances available. And so what Rio Tinto is saying is, this is what we can do to make the best of the situation. They're not able or willing to come in, scoop up all of the tailings, plug them back into the mine, concrete it up, and you know, make it as though it never were. And I think there are environmental groups that's what they advocate for. It's not done until it looks like it did in 1920. But there hasn't been a single case in Superfund history that they've actually returned something to its pristine pre-pollution state and called it good. Rio Tinto, I think, is saying, we're willing to clear our books, we're willing to do as right a thing as we can, but we can't return this to 1920.
Yeah, the one qualification I would say is there are sort of this two categories of Superfund sites, the ones where they treat things on site, and those where they basically try to take all of the contaminants and take them somewhere else. Mm-hmm. And in some of those cases, they get pretty good, a pretty good job of returning that site to a more or less natural state. But they've done it by moving the problem somewhere else, and at a huge cost, sometimes a higher cost.
If you look at that map in the wall there, it shows these stopes, you know, these large caverns that are hundreds and hundreds of feet across. suggests that there is a substantial risk in the event of an inevitable major earthquake that these things collapse. I mean, the whole mountainside opens up, and then all that water just sort of squirts out. I mean, I'm not a mining engineer, but it seems like if they could dig up 10 million tons of stuff in 20 years, it's already, you don't have to blow it up. You just run it in conveyors back. You put as much as you can back in the mountain, and that's a pretty permanent fix. That way the mountain doesn't collapse. You've got a lot less stuff leaching out of the... Did you check anything about that? Have they seriously looked at that?
I know it's one of those things that comes up fairly often in the conversation. They did, when they right before they closed the mine, I understand the lower reaches of the mine, they did start pumping tailings back in.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's part of the contributing to the pollutants coming out of the portal. But what you're saying is putting back in, then you have one source of pollutants you can deal with. But I don't know, constructability or if it's a logistical thing that it's deemed reasonably expensive. I'm not sure.
It seems like the probability would be that you cause more contamination at Railroad Creek in the process.
Yeah.
It'd be sort of like we were talking about Lake Coeur d'Alene, leaving the north end of Coeur d'Alene the way it is and not digging out those metals is probably a less environmentally impactful thing than actually trying to clean it up, because you stir up all of that stuff. In the process of cracking open the tailings and trying to scoop them back in, there would be inevitably a greater wash down into Railroad Creek, and
mm-hmm.
you'd probably cause more pollution. It's not like asbestos abatement where you can put up a big plastic tent over Copper Creek and make sure that none of that stuff ever gets out.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you're going to have to move a lot of the tailings to regrade it, right? I mean, you're going to move the river over closer to the village so that you can, decrease the slope of the tailings.
Chuck, you commented that maybe in the new plan the moving of the creek is minimal.
Yeah, there's a philosophical thing that's being argued right now. How much, where to move the creek, how much to move the creek between the mining company and the agencies. And so it's not clear what's going to come out in record of decision, but to some degree the creek's going to move, and most likely in the practical places where they need to create the space to put the barrier wall down. But the toll of the tailings, I don't know if they're going to bring, they might bring that back a bit and then bring the slope back and put those tailings back on top.
Back higher up.
Mm-hmm. Will they preserve the beautiful growth on the tailings, or will that all be sheared off in this regrade? Do we know about the, I mean, we have great vegetation on the tailings right now.
I think it'll all go. I mean, I think it's conceivable that there would be places where some of it stays and they're grading around. But I think the expectation, as I understand it, would be that all the vegetation on top of the tailings and really the majority of the vegetation around the tailings. I mean, this is going to be a huge earth-moving site for a couple of years. And I think there'll just have to be a lot of vegetation that goes in the short term. Mm-hmm. And when I said big questions, I think the first one that is we've already moved into is... is it possible that you do more harm, more environmental harm in your cleanup process than the situation as it stands right now? As I said, I mean, I now erased the pollution part that was up there, but you do have very real pollution. You do have very real impacts on that aquatic ecosystem that's up there. But this process will involve huge impacts on the land, all the way in some ways between here and Lake Chelan. One of the issues that came up at the meeting the other day is the issue of putting in rock quarries and borrow pits. I mean, they're going to need a lot of extra rock, basically, to do the capping process as they go through from here. So there'll be those big impacts on the land, big impacts on the creek. I think it's still a question of how much they end up moving the creek, but at least part of that will be moved. But I think it's safe to say that although they'll do a lot, and I have a high degree of confidence in the company doing the work, there's still going to be major impacts to this, to the riparian zone, to that sort of ecosystem in the process from there. You have this question of where you put that treatment plant that operates over a long period of time, and what you do with the byproducts of that treatment plant. The current plan, as I understand it, and this is still a little bit up, is actually to take that the sludge that comes out of that wastewater treatment plant, and essentially to come up with a type of landfill on top of the tailings in which they would put that back there, but in a way that they attempt to contain it in the way that you would with a regular sanitary landfill where we put our garbage from there. And the sort of process of regrading and capping the tailings along the way. I think there's just no disputing that there will be a huge environmental impact from the remediation effort. And at least in the short term, there is, I think, a really good likelihood that it will have a much greater environmental impact. The pollution is real, the risks are real, but they're not huge in the grand scheme of things right now. I mean, maybe it's because I live in the agricultural zone of the Midwest where dead creeks are kind of the norm, it seems like, and the pollution levels are very high sort of throughout the state of Iowa. And Peter Hernes, who is here, was talking about 71,000 impaired waterways across the United States from there. And so it's the pollution there is real, but it's in the grand scheme of water pollution in the United States, it's not a huge sort of issue from there. And part of, I think, what's at work here is the Superfund law in particular is really based on this principle that, you know, you got to clean up your mess. And you made that mess, and now you need to make it right. And particularly in a case where you have an identifiable responsible party. In many Superfund cases, the original polluter is long gone. That company was bankrupt and no longer exists. So the term Superfund really refers to the fact that there's a big fund of billions of dollars of money that is used to clean up sites where you don't have an identifiable responsible party from there. Here, you've got a responsible party. They're willing to pay. We believe that the polluter should pay. I believe that my four-year-old should clean up the mess that she makes in our room up in the chalet, and in some ways it's the same sort of principle that we're bringing back in again. And then the question I'm raising is, what if you sort of set aside that and say, no, no, let's do the cost-benefit analysis. Not necessarily the money cost-benefit, the money's there. My guess is that Rio Tinto's got $300 million sitting in a mason jar in somebody's backyard just waiting to pay this out. That the money is waiting there, so it's not that. But what if we weigh it out and say, what are the harms as they exist now? What are the benefits of the cleanup? What are the costs of the cleanup? How does that sort of work itself out?
Yeah. It seems to me that if we're looking in the short term, it's probably not worth it. Mm-hmm. Based on what you've said, it's going to do so much more damage in terms of the ecosystem and ecologically than what it's worth. However, it's not just a short-term issue. Mm-hmm. That if we're talking about slide risk, or as you say, slide certainty, that in the next 50, 100, 200, 300 years, we have the potential for these tailings to slide, and all of a sudden, then we're not facing just minor, you know, 5-mile radius of pollution, but all of a sudden, Lake Chelan, which is a totally new kind of ballgame in terms of a different ecosystem, different populations being affected. And I think based on that and that risk, that something has to be done. Mm-hmm. It's as unfortunate as it is, mm-hmm, in terms of what the cost will be. Mm-hmm. That risk is, I think, where that in the cost benefit stuff where that lies.
Mm-hmm. So it requires sort of looking beyond the short term to the long term in order to adjust.
Which is hard for people like us who are at Holden for, you know, a short amount of time and thoroughly, you know, enjoying our time here. It's hard to say that that's going to be worth it when you're looking at, you know, totally changing the kind of atmosphere that we experience at a place like Holden for 2 weeks or a year or, you know, whatever, however long it is, for something that's 200 years down the road.
Yeah, I guess that's where I'm coming from as well, too, that you really have to look, you know, when you do the cost-benefit. That's exactly, everything you said is exactly right. You know, right now, there's really minimal, I mean, it's a small part of the stream. We don't have the air pollution anymore. So if everything could stay like it is, let's leave it. I mean, we really don't have a big, but we know it's not going to stay that way. We know what's going to happen. And there's going to be something catastrophic. That's just the way the systems work. The mudslide coming off that could, I don't know, I'm not a hydrogeologist, but if you had a big flow, a big wet winter and a big wet spring, and those timbers that you talked about give way, I don't know where that stuff's going to go. I would think it hits here, and if there's people here, right. So you've got a human catastrophe, very possibly. You've got an ecological disaster. And then once that spreads, now how do you contain it? I guess what I think of is, yeah, you know, right now status quo. And so the big question for me is, can Rio Tinto do something that's going to deal with a, like you said the other night, what did you say, a nine? Category nine or so? I think that's where you have to be designing. If you're thinking about just containing the water, you know, whatever, that's not a big deal. But I think what the focus really has to be on, if we're going to do this, if we're really doing the cost benefit, it has to be on that really catastrophic level. Otherwise, it's not working.
At the same time, if you expand the scope even further, if we get out of human time and sort of think about world time beyond 200 years, and I think that's the guideline for the water treatment plant, right? That it's supposed to be sustainable for 200 years. You get beyond 200, 300 years. Let's say that 10 years from now, that cataclysmic slide happens.
Are we any better than if we'd done
it? 200 years out, you're not going to be able to really tell the difference between having done something and having done nothing. This valley is going to be changed but altered. But 5 years after that slide, the plume in Lake Chelan would settle out. It would be in the deepest basin in North America, and the real long-term effects would be minimal. And so you go back to the argument, you scale out time even further, and doing nothing becomes...
Yeah, what's your time scale?
Yeah, quite a rational decision. That the people in Chelan and downstream 200 years from now aren't going to know that you did anything that happens. And if, you know, major avalanche is a risk to the village every winter. You know, every winter there's a possibility that the village or big chunks of it, the chalets, could be destroyed by avalanche. It's just the nature of choosing to live on the side of a mountain in a geologically active zone. I mean, that's part of the tenacious nature of it.
There was a permanent solution proposed back in the 30s. And that solution was to put a pipe and to pipe the tailings down to the bottom of the lake. These heavy metals only come into solution when they're oxidized. You put them in 1,500 feet below the water level, there's basically no oxygen, so they're chemically inert, stable. Mm-hmm. You can put in a big pipeline over the course of a few years. You just pipe all 8 tons of tailings down to the bottom of the lake, and they are chemically inert. They're out of sight. Restore the wetlands. You don't have to worry about, you know, the retaining wall getting away. Who's going to operate the water treatment plant in 50 or 100 years? And it would require very little change. You don't need a big rock quarry. You need all the noise. And it's a long term fix.
So why was it discarded?
I don't know. It's back in the 30s. That's something the mining company looked at. I think they just decided it's cheaper just to pile it up.
They did have a comparable site in British Columbia where they did that. It's kind of in a sound. Mm-hmm. It might be how sound. Where they put, that's what they did. I think if there is an impact where they put it, but I don't know if it was this deep as this site. But there were a number of, I know there were other proposals that they made to like the Forest Service in the 30s and hydro plant and things like that. It might have been Forest Service and other governmental input on that. Mm-hmm.
Other comments or questions on this question of causing more damage in the short term than the long term?
One of the questions that I have, we keep on talking about hydropower, but in the near term, there's going to be diesel generators that are going to power a lot of the work, right? Like, they're not going to be able to build a new hydro plant and run off of hydroelectric power in the next 2 years. Right. So there's the probability is that this construction is going to be power. A lot of work is going to be diesel generators,
be
and so you're going
to have... That's helping we'll be providing some power as well.
So there's going to be noise and air pollution as a function of running diesel generators 24/7.
And not mentioning the amount of diesel and exhaust of machinery running.
And there will be variable spills of diesel and oil that come with running diesel machinery and stuff spills.
Yeah, and just, I mean, one of the things that that I'm trying to do anyway is to try to think about energy and carbon costs of almost everything that you do. And you start thinking not just about the $120 million or whatever that they're going to pay to do that, but the probably millions of gallons of diesel that are involved and the tons and tons of carbon dioxide that are produced in that process is one way of sort of weighing out as opposed to the pollution.
What do you think should be done? You're very knowledgeable about all this, and I'm just curious. What do you think should be? If you could be the single decision maker,
I'm the king
for a day. King for a day.
I will answer your question, but I want to do it by way of sort of taking it back around for just a minute, because I do think if you do the cost benefit analysis on this, even if you take that sort of long term, say, slide risk into account, it's not at all clear to me that it favors remediation. I think this will be very damaging environmentally, have a huge cost in dollars and in energy and sort of the impacts that are there. And maybe it's because I'm not an engineer. I don't have quite the same fear of the sort of risk of the kind of catastrophic slide that's there from there. So it is. I mean, I do think this is a case where there's this kind of principle, as I was saying with my kids, that the polluter must pay that's driving what's going on here from there. And if you did the cost-benefit, which we do with lots of government actions, I think it probably does not support at least the scale of remediation that we're talking about here. But the other thing, if we keep it in mind in the larger context of sort of cleanups and government decision-making, I was having this conversation with somebody to say, what if we opened up every toxic pollution site to a cost-benefit analysis? And essentially what we do is we open up every one of those cases to corporate lawyers arguing about costs and benefits in court. And I think that there are really smart, really well-paid lawyers that could make persuasive cases against remediation in almost all cases of cleanup.
From a utilitarian standpoint, the utility isn't there to do cleanup, so then you're into categorical ethics.
That's right.
The right thing to do.
Right. Yeah. So I one of the reasons why I think the remediation probably ought to go forward is because I think setting the precedent of weighing out the costs and benefits of every one of these cases, when what we're talking about is very sophisticated lawyers that are doing a lot of that work, I think would have a large negative effect, which really doesn't have a whole lot to do with the whole mine, but has a tremendous amount to do with how do we make these sorts of decisions. Is it a categorical, you made the mess, you need to clean it up, or is it a, let's sit down and argue about what the costs and benefits are, given a tremendous amount of sort of uncertainty about what's going to happen in the future. So I guess I am not as convinced of the specific details of exactly what's going to be done, particularly with the water treatment piece of this. I mean, I worry about these cases where essentially you say, all right, we're going to build this plant, and we're going to treat this water, and yeah, we'll sort of figure out what we're going to do with the sludge later on.
So could something be done that addresses some of this, but not, I mean, I'm sure there's been many options put on the table, but scaling it back, say?
Yeah, I mean, there have been tons of options on the table. I think what's driving this is they need to, the current sort of regulatory framework requires them to get to water quality standards that meet a certain level of standard. I think this is how they're going to do that. I don't think there's a significantly scaled back version that would achieve water quality in the short term in Railroad Creek that they need to meet Washington State standards from there. So I think you'd have to change the regulatory framework in order to sort of scale it back in a significant
conveniently,
way.
Conveniently, there's a delay period built in at some point here where maybe some of that could happen.
Yeah, I mean, so there are a variety of things that could happen, particularly if it doesn't go forward right away. But the mining company wants it to happen, and I think it's going to. I don't know exactly when, and Chuck, maybe you can comment on that. At some point, if the record decision doesn't come forward soon, they're going to have to revise that schedule. But they are going forward they're cutting trees today, which is part of that process of doing some of the lead-up work, even though the decision hasn't been finalized.
And part of the energy, I've talked to the Forest Service lately, part of the energy on why it's taking a bit longer for the record decision to come out has been responding to all these comments, but also they have a willing company, the mining company, willing to do the work, and they have been driving these early works projects, and they have been spending a considerable amount of energy approving and actually amending the administrative order to include these early works. And so that's, so at the one time, it, on the one perspective, there's all this record decision and all of this other things aren't happening. On the other hand, the lead up to the actual, actually this whole thing working is vigorously happening.
So, mm-hmm. So you have momentum that's...
There's a lot of momentum. There isn't a... It appears, if you look at just at the formal decisions, that there might be a stall out happening, but actually back behind the scenes, there's a tremendous amount of energy.
Because you have a willing party that's willing to pay and do it.
And wanting to go now.
That's the whole change of the story, the whole thing. I think we could have settled with a $10 million project, $20 million project, 10 years ago. Mm-hmm. We could have just said, we'll do it. But Intelco wasn't, as I understand it, prepared or willing to do that. So,
were they talking about doing the same things we're talking about today, or was it different?
Quite a bit different, and scaled back tremendously. But like John said, the regulatory environment right now
has changed.
Yeah, and the Northwest, Pacific Northwest, has some of the, you know, specifics, some of the strictest environmental policy.
So you got to meet those Washington water quality standards.
Isn't there a small possibility that just a couple of owls could really throw this whole thing into it? Seriously, because there's some Forest Service workers that are doing surveys right now to see whether or not there are spotted owls in the area that is potentially going to be negatively impacted. So you could end up with the Endangered Species Act conflicting with remediation because you can't disrupt that habitat.
Yep.
I mean, isn't that a
oh, yeah.
I hadn't thought about it, but yeah. I mean, I don't know about right around here, but sort of between here and the lake, there is spotted owl critical habitat areas.
There's a couple of Forest Service workers that are walking around counting owls at night right now.
Yeah, we're in a late succession reserve, the ideal habitat for spotted owls in this valley. There are many spots that it's likely they've never heard one or never spotted one. But it is still classified like that, so we have to be... use precautions, and they will for the constructions during the mating season, and nesting season, and so of the possible spotted owls.
The owl surveys have been going on since, my understanding, 1997, six times a year. It's not just unique to right now.
No, it's just the reality is that a couple of nesting owls could throw this
right.
whole thing
no,
into
that's,
a
that's
different
keep trying to hear.
Can I get a recording of that? Just to
Chuck, anything else you want to add to the?
What's there? You did a tremendous job.
Yeah,
thank you. It was a good discussion.
Chuck, has there ever been a time when, like, the Forest Service, historically, not just right now because of this, you said, hey, you guys need to just.
Right.
If you're going to general public,
I thought in the age of PowerPoint, it's so easy to be able to show graphs of contamination, etc. But I guess I'm old-fashioned in a way that I tend to fall back to a chalkboard or a whiteboard so often.
And the only additional thing, which was not very easy to do,
immediately they flushed into the
thing that would be
Forest Service came up here
a little more clear, would be able to have a nice JPEG of that map and be able to here's what we're looking at.
And actually, I forgot. It's going to be upstairs on the hallway. You've got a decent sized aerial photo that's sort of laid out. Well, I meant to lay it down and I forgot. So Thanks for coming. I appreciate
it.
I
realize that.
You left the upper Iowa and
Whippy Dick.
You know, I did. You know Decorah well, or are you?
My daughter is
Oh, great. When was she there?
She graduated in 98.
Okay. Good. She had a good experience?
She loved it. I tried real hard to get her to go to Concordia.
Is that your alma mater?
Yeah. And, no, Dad, no, 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 I'm not going to be a carver.
Our academic dean just left Luther to become the new president at Concordia.
I saw that.
He's a great guy. He's been a great leader. So, I mean, it's a little hard to know. A president's a different role than a chief academic officer.
I'm blanking on names, but
Bill Kraft is his name.
Yeah, but when my daughter was signing up for her freshman classes, she had me standing in one line to save her place, and somebody who was signing up students called me out. You're Nancy's brother, aren't you?
Yeah.
Get over here. She was an instructor at Luther, and her husband was in charge of fundraising. She was out. And I'm trying to think of the name of the. They were the first house off campus. So they gave me the invitation. When you come to visit your daughter, you've got a place to stay.
Wow.
And I like that. I don't think I could get that at Concordia. Oh,
that's great. No, it's a good place.
It is.
We enjoyed being there. And
we're so lucky. I've got two godchildren, one who went to Gustavus against my better wishes, and the other who went to St. Olaf's. I said, well, I can't complain. You guys have got educations, and you're